This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Jerry McKesson has a new book, On the Other Side of Freedom, The Case for Hope, which in some ways reminds me of Studs Terkel, I mean, his last book, which is the same argument, but from a very different point of view. You have, just if you're not familiar, which is probably unlikely, but he's a civil rights activist, community organizer, host of Crooked Media's podcast, Pod Save the People. Fortune magazine named him number 11 in the world's greatest leaders, Harvard's Black Man of the Year in 2016. He's with the Black Lives Matter movement, of course, co-founder of Campaign Zero. DeRay, welcome to the program.
It's good to be here.
It's great to have you with us. So tell us about your middle-of-the-night realization that led you to drive 9 hours to Minneapolis.
Yeah, so my friend got killed on August 9th, and on August 16th, I was sitting on my couch, and I was like, I saw what was happening on CNN. That looked like the protesters were wrong. I saw what was happening on Twitter. It looked like the police are wrong. And I was like, I need to go see for myself what's happening. So I went down. I met up with people who were on the ground already, and that changed everything. The second night that I was in St. Louis was the first night that I was tear gassed, and I was like, nobody should ever have to experience this. I'll do whatever I can to make sure.
This was around the Michael Brown killing?
Yeah, around Michael Brown's death. And I was like, I'll do whatever I can to make sure this never happens. So I quit, and you know, the rest is history.
Wow, you've come a long way. You pointed out to me in our conversation before we came on the air, chapter 3. It's kind of the most autobiographical chapter. What are the high points that you'd like people to know about?
Yeah, so in the book, I talk about things that you'd expect, like the police and the protests. But in chapter 3, really a deep dive into some of the things that we know now that we just didn't know before. So We created the first public database of police union contracts and use of force policies in the country. So you think about things like, I don't know if you knew that in California, there's a law that says that any investigation of an officer that lasts more than a year can never result in discipline, regardless of the outcome.
Really?
It's a law? It's the law.
Oh, my God.
In Cleveland, in the police union contract, it says that they destroy police officer disciplinary records every 2 years.
That's nuts.
And the law in Maryland says that you can file an anonymous complaint against an officer for everything except brutality. So we did a lot of work to uncover, and that's just like the tip of the iceberg. We did a lot of work around the policies and practices that almost guarantee that officers won't be held accountable. And the second part is we did a lot of data work. So, you know, the government can tell you the rainfall in rural Missouri in 1902, but literally can't tell you how many people were killed last year by the police. Yeah. There have been some years where Florida, for instance, has reported zero killings by police, and like we know that's not true. So we did a lot of data cleansing to try and figure out what was going on. And learned a lot of things. So we know that Black people are actually more likely to be unarmed and not threatening than any other race of people impacted by police violence. We know that there's no relationship between police violence and community violence. So we learned a lot of things, and that's in chapter 3.
Yeah, you write one in every three people killed by a stranger in this country
is killed by a police officer.
Is killed by a cop, and an additional 50,000 people are hospitalized every year as a result of violence inflicted upon them by police.
Yeah, it's wild. So one of the recognitions early was that like this is not just a problem in Ferguson and St. Louis; it's a problem in the country.
Yeah, we have I wrote an article some time ago about how modern policing in many ways, particularly in the South, came out of the old slave patrols.
Right.
And how many of essentially the worldview is still a slave patrol worldview. In fact, I wrote a book about this, which won't be out until next spring, but same thing, the hidden history of the Second Amendment, and how that all came out of the slave patrols as well. How do we fix this?
I think there are a couple of things. One is like a recognition that we can think about safety beyond policing, that there has to be a way that we can keep communities safe that doesn't require people to have guns, it doesn't require people to be arrested and put in cages. The second is, as we get to that vision, that bigger vision, it is about, at the very least, if we have to have the police right now, then they need to be held accountable. So when we looked at all the practices and laws that almost guarantee they won't be held accountable, we're no longer shocked. We're like, it makes total sense that, like, you're not held accountable. If the investigation lasts more than a year, it can't result in discipline. Like, that's wild. The second piece, too, or the third piece, is, like, how do we start to peel back, like, how mass incarceration became mass? So you think about, like, tell me something you can buy for $300.
You mean right now?
Anything.
Yeah, a cheap phone?
A cheap phone. So in Florida, to this day, theft over $300 is a felony. And when you become a felon, you permanently lose the right to vote. It's wild.
Yeah.
So, like, you think about when you ask most people what's a felon, they're like, oh, killed 10 people, robbed a bank. It's like, nope. Imagine, like, stealing a cheap phone. And, like, you lose the right to vote forever. That's, like, a wild consequence. And part of this is, like, we should just look at, like, what are the things that we consider crimes and start to reevaluate? Does that actually make sense at scale? Well, you know, we arrest more people for weed than all violent crimes combined. That's wild.
I know, that's crazy. And that, you know, Canada next month is completely legalizing pot all across the country.
There we go.
We need to be doing that. But that $300 thing, I mean, that's something that should be, I would think, subject to some sort of public pressure. You know, when I was a kid in the 60s, the minimum wage was $1.25 or $1.35 an hour. $600 was 500 hours of work.
Right.
Today, $600 is not 500 hours of work.
Exactly.
And so it represents a completely different thing. And, you know, not to say that, you know, the threshold should be massively higher than that.
In Oklahoma, up until 2001, it was $50 was a felony. That's wild. You know, like, I probably stolen $50 worth of something by mistake, you know, just like forgetting to go to the counter and like all of a sudden. But people forget those things, you know?
Yeah, the institution of policing. You write about the golden age of the bully of white supremacy.
Yeah, this moment, so that chapter, the chapter's called The Bully in the Pulpit. And in that chapter, I use the metaphor of the bully to think about, like, what is happening in this current context. Somebody asked me, would I ever meet with Trump? And it was like, you know, my job isn't to tell the bully that I'm a real person. The bully already knows, right? Like, he already knows that that is real. So that's what that chapter is a meditation on. I'm also interested in, like, how we start to think about, like, some of the things that aren't as sexy around, like, general inequity. So, like, do you know why kids... eat paint chips, like lead paint chips? Do you know what?
Sweet.
Lead
is
sweet. How did you know that?
I grew up in a house that had lead.
It's sweet. I had no clue.
That's right.
So when you think about it being sweet, and you think about the period of time in this country where we mandated that the paint and housing projects be lead-based paint,
yeah,
it's like, if I didn't think there was a conspiracy before, I'm like convinced it is now, you know? Yeah. And like, how do we start to peel all of those things back when we think about the work of justice?
Yeah, it's big stuff. Tell me, your blue vest has become a logo for you. You wear it wherever you go. You're in media appearances and things. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I write about it in the book, but it reminds me of, you know, we were in the street for 400 days. So if you ever start some marching, it wasn't that we thought marching was cool. It was that it was illegal to stand still. And we couldn't stand still in August, September, October 2014. If we stood still,
you violate the loitering laws, right?
No, they made a new rule. It's called the 5-second rule. So if you stood still for more than 5 seconds, you were arrested. It was like a wild thing.
Wow.
The police, I think, thought that we were gonna be tired and go home. And instead, we were like, well, if we got to walk all day, you got to walk all day. And like that, sort of, we just walked all day and all night. And the vest, you know, I started wearing it when it got cold because we've been in the street for a long time. And I needed something that I could wear that I never have to pack. And today it just reminds me, it's like my tattoo, you know?
Yeah.
It reminds me that what we went through was real. I never want to forget how fragile democracy is, how easy it was for them to make up a rule being like, you can't stand still for more than 5 seconds.
This is in Ferguson? Maybe?
This is in St. Louis. Yeah, it was like the region. But I never want to forget those things.
Yeah, yeah, good idea. Distinction between whiteness and white people. This concept of whiteness is a social construct that has been turned into a legal construct that has become, you know, again, going back to the slave patrol thing, this, you know, this idea of white, speak to that.
Yeah, you know, the chapter's called The Choreography of Whiteness, and like trying to help people name things. So like we think about white supremacy as the idea that white people are better, more worthy, and are normal, or like the standard for normal. We think about whiteness as the culture that has just birthed, and how that, like, it's like a smog, right? It seeps into everything. And then we think about people, like white people as a people who benefit from those things, whether they intentionally perpetuate them or not. And we think about the recognition of white privilege. It's a recognition that people benefit from something they didn't necessarily work for, but they do benefit at scale. And the most important thing that white people can do when they sort of have that recognition of privilege is understand, like, not only do they benefit at the personal level, but there's something at the system level that even, like, allows that to happen. So the chapter sort of deals with, like, denial and white guilt and shame, and like how whiteness sort of manifests as people are trying to work through it.
How do we, this is a change, a fundamental change that has to happen, it seems to me, in large part within the white community. And white people need to be talking to white people about this.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's the best way to do that?
So I think some of it is starting where you are, right? Saying like, here are the issues that I think are important, and like, saying we should do something about them. The second is like knowing an issue really well. So one of the things that I find when I travel across the country is that people sort of know top line issues, but they actually like, you're like, they're like, Dre, I want to do something about mass incarceration. You're like, What do you care about with mass incarceration? And they're like, mass incarceration? And you're like, that's not helpful, right? Like, what part of
the bumper sticker?
Yeah, like the system is very big. So there are enough problems that we can actually align the work to like whatever you're interested in, and like people need to be interested. And the third is that what white people can do that people of color just can only do differently is like use the access and the resources to really challenge systems in a way that they just won't push back as hard on you because you're white. So what does it mean? You know, I think about being in Austin when the Austin organizers got the whole city council to vote against the police union contract unanimously. Is that it was actually powerful that there were so many white people who came up and said like, this just isn't right, right? Like this is a racial justice issue. This is also just an equity issue. This also just isn't fair. And they aren't, you know, in Austin, they're not impacted in the same way by the police, but they understood that like it meant something important for the city council to say, like, we care too, and we're your constituents. So some of it is that.
It seemed to me for some time, for five, maybe 10 years now, that this disruptive technology of having a camera in every phone and having a phone everywhere brought us all these videos of police killing unarmed black men that just became the wallpaper of the last 5 years or more, but really breaking through into the press. And that this has created a moment, an opportunity, an awareness and an awakeness among, white people who were not paying attention before.
Right.
That needs to be exploited.
And the awareness is good. You know, the challenge is that the outcomes haven't changed, right?
Right.
So in 4 years, we have definitely started a national conversation about race and justice in a way that just didn't exist 4 years ago. The outcomes are still really bad. So the question becomes, how do we make sure that people don't get stuck in the awareness cycle, right? That they're like, oh, I know, this is really bad. Because the question is like, what do we do? And you even think about like Stephon Clark being killed in Sacramento. Is that what came out of that is people started like $1 million opportunity fund and like, yes, there should be opportunity. But remember, the lack of opportunity isn't what killed Stephon Clark, right? Like it was the police.
Yeah.
So how do we start to like make sure that the solutions that we put forth like are good solutions for the actual problem that manifested and not like other problems?
Yeah. Politics has become polluted with this. There's been, you know, for some time, you know, progressive politicians have been talking about the need for addressing racial issues, but it seems like we're way behind on that. Oh, I'm sorry, we're hitting the break here. I thought I had another minute. DeRay McKesson, his new book is On the Other Side of Freedom, The Case for Hope. DeRay, thanks so much for being with us.
So good to be here.
It's great to meet you. And his pod Save the People from Crooked Media. So check it out. DeRay, thank you very much. Great having you. We'll be back with more of the news of the day and your calls in just a minute. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back in just a moment with more of your calls, more of the news of the day. Stick around. And welcome back. Let's see here. Carol in Montana watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, Carol, what's on your mind today?
I wish they'd quit tippy-toeing around what Kavanaugh has committed here or appears to have committed here is not sexual assault or harassment. What he committed or is accused of committing, and they won't come out and say it.
It's attempted rape.
Statutory rape.
Right. Attempted. But yes.
Because she had been drinking and she was underage.
Yep. She was 15 and he was 17.
It doesn't matter. It was statutory rape.
Yep, I agree. And this is why you need the FBI to investigate this. We're talking about a crime here.
Amen.
Yeah. Okay. Carol, thanks a lot. Very, very well said, and I appreciate your calling in from Montana. Tim in Cedar Grove, North Carolina. Hey, Tim, what's on your mind today?
Well, I was wondering what you think the GOP, which I consider the government of Putin, but the GOP, if they're... what are they going to run on if they are able to make abortion illegal?
They're going to allow individual states to make it illegal. I guarantee you. If Brett Kavanaugh is put on the Supreme Court, by the end of next year, Roe v. Wade will be overturned.
But what will the Republicans then run on? They've been running on this for 40-some-odd years. What are they going to run on now?
That's a good question, because I think that this is going to backfire on them badly. Once... You've got a generation of women who have no idea what it's like to live in a society where abortion is illegal. where women are dying from back alley abortions, where people are going to prison for getting abortions or for providing abortions. And when we slide into that world, I mean, the women who became the women's movement of the 60s and 70s knew that world well. You know, abortion was not decriminalized until 1973. And most of us, most people of my age, know about, if they don't know somebody who died from a bad back alley abortion or don't know somebody who had an illegal abortion, they know of somebody who did. I there was a girl in my high school class who died from an illegal abortion that, you know, she got an infection and just didn't come back to school anymore. And
why don't the Democrats press that fact?
I don't think they do either.
It's not going to stop abortion. It's just going to make abortion more dangerous.
That's absolutely right. And it may take a decade. It may take a few years for Republicans to put into place these draconian laws and for them to piss off enough women, young women who are coming up and saying, hey, wait a minute. Something happens. I have an accident. This is not what I wanted. This is not what I planned. I should have the right to control my own body. This is not just a personal issue and not just a privacy issue. It's also an economic issue, which makes it an issue of power. And of course, it was an issue of power from the get-go. And I think that, if the Republicans get their way, they're gonna discover that suddenly they're far more radioactive than they thought they were. They've been pandering to this small minority of hardcore Catholics and evangelicals up to this point. And I don't think it's gonna wash, once they actually start changing the laws. Tim, well said. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. It's 22 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with more of your calls here on the Tom Hartman Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance, no way, get out of here. What are you saying? We'll be right back. We are back. It's 24 minutes past the hour. Oh, my. A lot going on. We've been talking in the first hour of the program, if you're just tuning in. We spent the hour talking about principally two topics. The first is Brett Kavanaugh and Dr. Christine Ford, Christine Blasey Ford, and whether, what her strategy should be. Should she just do a whole, do the full Michael Avenatti and go out and do a whole media thing and just bury these Republicans in their own BS? If they're unwilling to put the FBI on this job, it only took 3 days for the FBI to investigate Anita Hill's accusations, and they came back and said, could be. Could be. We haven't been able to find any evidence one way or the other, but Anita Hill did not have a witness who was afraid to lie to the FBI. And, there's a big question. Will Mark Judge lie to the FBI if he's interrogated, if he's questioned? For that matter, will Brett Kavanaugh lie to the FBI? I think he probably would. He's already lied to the Senate under oath on at least three occasions that we know of. He lied about having participated in spreading stolen Democratic documents. He lied about having received them. He lied about knowing that they were stolen when the headline was, stolen documents, essentially. I mean, we know that Brett Kavanaugh is a liar, which makes him, the perfect guy for Donald Trump. We know that Brett Kavanaugh thinks that Republican presidents should be able to do anything they want without interference from special prosecutors and things like that. We know that Brett Kavanaugh was the guy who was on Ken Starr's staff, who encouraged Ken Starr to reopen the investigation into Vince Foster terrorizing him, horrifying his family, and rewounding them all over again, and that he pushed it and pushed it and pushed it to the point that they went back to his family, to Vince Foster's family, to get hair for DNA analysis. Yes, maybe Hillary Clinton did kill him. I mean, that's, honest to God, Brett Kavanaugh was pushing this when he was in Ken Starr's office. But now that you got a Republican president, oh no, we should not be investigating presidents. And of course, that's why Donald Trump said, put him on the Supreme Court. He's as corrupt as I am, Trump says. So how does Christine Ford, Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, handle this? If she has the personality, if she has the personal ability, and that's something that we don't know. If she has the personality to do a Michael Avenatti, she should go, in my opinion, she should go into the Senate and she should totally kick those guys' asses. She should call them out as old white men, the Republicans. She should point out their hypocrisy. She should point out that an FBI investigation could have been done in 3 days and just nail them. If she doesn't have the personality for that, then I think that she should be doing a media blitz. If she doesn't have the personality for that, then I think, you know, she's done what she can do, but and her family's in hiding. So a lot, this is going to depend on her. She has to make these choices and decisions based on what she's capable of doing. How much can she take? How far can she go in, you know, in the media world and going up against these senators? This is really tough stuff. I get on the radio and TV all the time, and it still scares the hell out of me. I can't imagine being in her position. We'll be back with your calls after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
What do you think she should do? We were also talking about the amazing pollution from these hog farms, this Chinese hog operation in North Carolina. We'll be back. Boy, what a day. Grace is tweeting at me. I'm wondering what kind of lousy background checks the FBI did on Kavanaugh. Perhaps that should be investigated. Heavy drinking, rape attempt rumors, the gambling, the stolen emails, the credit card debt, the dirty conservative operatives, women's dress preferences. How did they miss all that? Well, that's a very good question. We've got a lot on the table here, a lot of stuff that we've been talking about, including, you know, what will happen if Brett Kavanaugh gets on the Supreme Court and overturns Roe v. Wade, which he has proclaimed is his goal. And on the line, Trish in Seattle. Hey, Trish, thanks for listening. What's up?
Hi. My grandmother died from an illegal abortion.
Oh, my goodness.
It was during the Depression. She had five children. I think she was 34. My mother was 10. Her youngest were twins that were 10 months old. So she got pregnant again, and her aunt gave her the abortion, and it killed her. And that changed my whole family's life for generations.
Yes.
My mother at 10 was trying to raise her family, you know, her younger siblings, and the twins ended up living with other relatives, and my mother's relationship with her only sister was more like a cousin because she barely saw her, because her aunt was afraid that if she let the kids be with their siblings, they'd want to live there, and so it became complicated, and it was difficult. It was difficult for everyone in the family because they had no mother and no money. And it was just a horrible situation. And one of my points is that women are not going to stop having abortions when they become illegal again.
Right.
Because I grew up in a time when they were illegal. I had friends that had abortions. I knew someone in high school that died from an illegal abortion. So it's a very real thing. Women, when they're desperate, are still going to have an abortion.
Yeah, I've told the story many times. I knew a girl in my high school who just stopped coming to school one day because it turned out she had died. She had an illegal abortion and had apparently gotten septic. You know, it got infected and
yep,
died from that, which is typical.
What happened to my grandmother. And all the children had to go into the room to say goodbye and see her dying.
Oh.
And I guess she had. It was just horrible.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'd never even thought about what the impact would be on the family. Now, as a parent and grandparent, you know, imagining what would happen if your daughter died as a result of an illegal abortion and how that would be just devastating to the family of that girl that was in my high school. I didn't know her personally. I just knew of her. But, you know, I think most people, Trish, you know, of who were old enough to be of age prior to 1973, which apparently includes you and me, have these stories to tell. And there's this entire generation of young women under, 40, who have grown up in a world where abortion is legal and safe and broadly available, although I get it that there's a lot of states where it's harder and harder to get. But if you have the money, it's still not as difficult, and you can always fly to a state where it's very easy to get. And those stories are going to change after Brett Kavanaugh is on the Supreme Court. The stories of safe abortion are going to start becoming the stories that you and I are talking about from pre-73. And that, I think is going to devastate the Republican Party. I really do. I could be wrong. Somebody tweeted to me a little bit ago saying, oh, you know, the Republicans will be just fine. I don't think so. Trish, thank you for sharing your story. That's amazing. Thank you so much. It's good to hear from you. Steve in Phoenix, Arizona, you wanted to weigh in on the whole Kavanaugh thing.
You betcha. Good morning, Tom. That is a devastating story, and I agree. It shouldn't be happening. One other thing, looking forward very much to seeing you and Michael on Bill's show tomorrow night. That's our go-to thing on Friday nights, as you know, and you guys can let it all hang out and really get after things. So looking forward to it.
Thank you. Hopefully I don't make too much of a fool of myself.
Oh, no. Just go for it. I love watching it.
Yeah.
Anyways, you know, bullies, they look after their own kind. They look after bullies. And, you know, they're there to protect their own. Republicans, they bullied the Democrats into relinquishing Obama's Supreme Court pick, and it continues today with Kavanaugh. Right. You know, there's really no transparency to any of this. You know, they've released, what, 10% of the documents?
Yep.
And they don't want us to find anything about Kavanaugh's dealings with the Ford woman. What is this? You know, it's all roads lead back to the underlying issue, which is tax cuts, you know, for the wealthy and deregulation. And this woman has, she's a college degree, very professional woman. She has nothing to gain by coming forward at this point in time, and everything to lose. She needs to be listened to and her story taken seriously.
Yeah, somebody tweeted that she's going to be on 60 Minutes November 4th. I can't verify that or confirm that, but if so, it's going to be very, very interesting. Steve, thank you, and spot on. Gail in Tucson, Arizona. Hey, Gail, thanks for watching us on Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hi, thank you. Can you hear me?
Just fine, yeah.
Okay. I was listening to Mike Papantonio, American's lawyer, last night.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking about how many judges Mitch McConnell and Trump are appointing to appellate courts and other lesser federal courts while all this hoopla is going on in the news about this one appointee to the Supreme Court judge. You know,
there's a larger strategy at work here. You're absolutely right.
Oh, much larger, and it's really insidious because so many environmental cases or people versus corporations are going to be coming up to those courts over the next 10, 20 years, and they'll all be decided in favor of corporations.
And rich people, yep.
Yes.
Absolutely, and they have been to a large extent, you know, for the last 20 years or so. This is a multi-generational effort, the Federalist Society, to bring up these right-wing cranks and put them in positions where they can make law as judges using judicial review and judicial supremacy.
And there's nothing being said about it on the regular news. Nothing.
Yeah.
We don't hear anything about it. It's just horrible. I mean, it even gave me less hope, you know, that anything can change because these old white men are setting things in concrete. Right. It seems like.
And that's who Trump is appointing, by the way, you know, disproportionately male and disproportionately white. Gail, thank you. We should get Mike Papantonio on to talk about that. That sounds like a great topic and the kind of thing that he'd be all over. Kino in Lakeland, Florida. Hey, Kino, what's up?
Hey, got a good report for the moose herders.
Republicans against Trump.
We're Republicans organizing to convince Pence to dump Trump. Now, let me give you some quick updates. We want in January for Congress, the coalition, Moose Herder Coalition, Democrats and Republicans, to form the Presidential Fitness Tribunal. And the 25th Amendment says that Congress can appoint a body. You can bypass the executive. So we want the Presidential Fitness Tribunal in January. Now, in the meantime, we need everybody to be aware the drama is changing between Trump and the FBI. And he tried to get those classified things released, and that means our spies, our friends and people that love us and try to help us in faraway countries are going to be captured and killed and tortured. And so this could prevent blood on his hands. So we moose herders sent a memo to Congress yesterday. Schumer and Marco Rubio were trying to recruit Marco Rubio to join the moose herders, and he can be a big man in history if he will join the moose herders. But we, in our memo, we said history praises those Germans who were insubordinate to the psychologically crazy Nazis. There can be all kind of psychologically crazy people, not necessarily Nazis, but other kind of craziness like Trump is doing. And so we can be aware that the FBI can be insubordinate with this man. And so I was...
But, Kino, the entire Republican Party is supporting him. Why not just stop being a Republican?
Oh, no, we got to develop reform within... a few of us got to develop reform within the Republican Party. And Rick Wilson's book, Everything That Trump Touches Dies, can be the basis for reform within the Republican Party and uphold the principles of Teddy Roosevelt. And
well, that would be a marvelous thing, Keno. I would love to see Teddy Roosevelt or Dwight Eisenhower's Republican Party come back. I was very familiar with that Republican Party. My dad was an Eisenhower Republican. And boy, I don't know of a single one anymore. Even the ones like Flake, who proclaim they are. No way.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with the news from Talk Media News in about 4 minutes. Stick around. And welcome back. Albert in Detroit watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, Albert, what's on your mind today?
Well, a few things real quick. This woman comes out of nowhere and says what she said. And everybody forgets that, you know, she's an American citizen, apply the law, and forget about it, because just follow the rules. And the next thing is, you got, I got so much to say, the other thing is, with this woman, I think she should come in on Monday and just do what she got to do there, because it'll be on the record for the whole world to see. If you don't do that, there'll be like a little check mark, a small book. This way, you can always go back into it, back into the history, and look at the video and see where she's definitely testified, and these small guys attacking her. That'd be great to have her.
Yeah, that's a very, very good point. And hopefully she will turn the tables on the Republicans.
It'll be easy because she'll have help.
Yeah.
Hopefully the woman from California will be there.
Yeah,
the prosecutor, Katina, is it?
Kamala Harris is Kamala, who you're thinking of.
Yeah, Kamala. Yeah. Last thing I want to say real
Kamala
quick,
Harris.
Got a long line here. Yeah, I noticed on liberal stations, they talk about everybody's book except Omarosa's book. You announced that?
We reached out to her and invited her on the show, and to the best of my knowledge, she never responded. Did she, Sean? You know? Yeah, she has not responded. So, you know, we tried, Albert. She's, you know, it would be fascinating to interview Omarosa. I would love to do that. Let's see here. Jamie, listening in Rentelier, Indiana. Is that right?
Rentelier. How are you, Tom?
Great. What's up?
I'm just calling you just a fast background. I mean, my degree is in ag production and soy management. So I spent about 8 years working in confinement operations.
Mm-hmm.
I managed 2 farms, 5,000 head of hogs apiece, and I left the industry to finally pursue a union job. So I'm an operating engineer with 150 out of Chicago there.
Mm-hmm.
And in Indiana here, Mike Pence is obviously a paradise here. They're pushing, especially in my county, they're pushing windmills out as being these dangerous contraptions. So like our commissioners, they're approving hog farms to be built, but saying zoning can't be allowed for wind farms. So that's the kind of thing that's going around in, you know, Republican-controlled areas. They just approved a $7.5 million bioresearch facility here in my county that's going to house 4,700 pigs for medical research. And, they're fighting windmills coming here because they said they're going to destroy our economy and hurt the environment, basically. That's actually, they're saying it's going to hurt our environment, but they're allowing hog farms, which I studied to work in and everything, but ventured away from that because of the conditions that I saw for 8 years of working inside these farms.
Right.
And
Do you know anybody who's ever tried to take pictures inside any of those hog farms and ended up in jail?
No, not in jail. I mean, I worked with them. I know a lot of people that still work there. And we never had anybody, while I managed the farms, we never had anybody come and take pictures. Somebody one time left a pig head in front of the farm, but I think that was a neighbor that was upset with pig hog operations. So they actually left a pig head on the stake in front of the farm.
Wow, that's amazing. Okay.
I got
to run, Jamie, but thanks a lot for the call. That's fascinating. We'll be back. It's coming up on 10 minutes before the hour. We're going to check in with Talk Media News in just a second. Stick around. We're going to, at the top of the hour, our Our friend Angela Baca is going to be with us. She is the marijuana expert, or cannabis expert, if you prefer that word. And, you know, I get it about the history of these words. And she will be taking your calls at 202-808-9925 if you have questions about pot. Right now, let's check in with Talk Media News and find out what's going on in the world. On the line with us, the author of Sideswiped, former Congressman Bob Ney. Congressman, welcome back. Oh, Bob's on hybrid one. I'll put him on two. I'm sorry. Hey, Bob.
Hi, Tom. Hi, how are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. I hope that's true of you.
Oh, I'm okay. I'm hanging in there.
All right, so what's going on in the world?
Well, don't you just love staffers in the U.S. House and Senate? And there's one staffer that should have stayed off of the tweets, although the president has made that popular these days, and that is Chief Staffer Mike Davis, and he's the committee's chief staffer for nominations for the Judiciary Committee. And he tweeted twice overnight about his key role in the committee's review of Christine Blasey Ford's allegations. And he tweeted as well as criticism of Ford's attorney and his desired outcome of the process. So in his attempt to, I guess, Tom, brag about things, he said, quote, "Unfazed and determined, we will confirm Judge Kavanaugh at confirm Kavanaugh at SCOTUS," and he tweeted at 11 p.m. on Wednesday. Now, right. He's trying to backtrack on this because 2 hours later, he also, before he backtracked, he said, "I personally questioned Judge Kavanaugh under penalty of felony and 5 years of imprisonment if he lies. I'm still waiting to hear back from the accuser's attorneys who can't find time between TV appearances to get back to me."
Sounds to me like he was drinking.
Well, he was at 11 p.m. and actually saying that, yeah, I think he had a few pops.
Yeah.
And that happens in D.C. Been there, done it. Yes, sir, that happens.
Yep. But it also reveals the mentality of the GOP these days. You know, this is raw power politics. This is, you know, they withheld a judge, Judge Merrick Garland, for a whole year, and now they're trying to jam a judge through in a matter of days, you know, weeks at the very most. This is wrong, Bob.
Yes, and this takes the mask off because what the staffer says, this is what Grassley has tried to claim, at least, out front that he's not doing. You know, he's right. Waiting to hear from the attorneys. Will they respond by, you know, Friday? Well, this is Wednesday night, so the chief staffer for nominations has already decided what's going to happen. You know, that, you know, he's done this, he's put him under oath, et cetera, et cetera. So this is kind of the mask coming off of what we all know is really going to happen there,
right.
Which is, you know, if Dr. Ford doesn't go out, they're not going to question Kavanaugh, and they will end up taking a vote. If for some reason that vote then ties, or there's not enough votes to come out of the committee, rather, then it can be thrown out of the committee anyway.
Yeah, Mitch McConnell will simply walk this to the floor himself.
I mean, absolutely. Yeah. And if Mitch McConnell stalled off something for a year's period of time, he can make something happen in minutes, obviously, with this.
Yep.
And I don't want to let a day go by here because we talked yesterday without mentioning Jeff Sessions, because if you look at the story that we were carrying actually this morning in the news, which was about how the Attorney General, who, you know, of course Trump says he doesn't have one, but the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, has said that he's going to impose new limits on immigration judges, saying that their authority to dismiss deportation cases, for example, Tom, may not exist. Okay, so this is a way to, obviously, without passing law, make immigration work, you know, for how the Trump administration wants to work it. Now, they have followed back up, though, today, actually, with the fact that the Attorney General is now taking a different tactic, and he is referring cases, and he's referring cases to himself, which is very fascinating because what he will do is analyze this and come out with an opinion. So he's imposing new limits on the judge's authorities, not only to dismiss the cases, but he's also saying that there may be mandatory detention for asylum seekers.
So basically, Jeff Sessions, the America's most racist Keebler elf, is continuing to promote the "we've got a crackdown on brown people coming across our southern border" meme, basically.
And he's going to do it himself. So what this could mean would be indefinite asylum seekers would have mandatory detention for whatever period of time. Now, this is even if they, this is a quote, even if they pass their credible fear interview. When you pass a credible fear interview, it takes you a step, obviously, closer. And
but so you're still going to go to jail. This, to what extent, Bob, do you think this is being driven by GEO, whatever it is, and CCC, the Correction Corporation of America, the companies, these private prison companies that have got these huge contracts from ICE to build these detention facilities? How much of this is being driven by that, by economic concerns?
Oh, absolutely. I think a lot of it is. Look, you know, I was incarcerated, and I saw what the companies were doing and what money they were making out of, frankly, food that was not even a quality sometimes, you know, for people to be able to properly eat. And I know what people say, well, they're all in prison, they deserve it. Well, I mean, they deserve to not eat constantly, you know, wilted lettuce, et cetera, which is right. I personally saw it. And beyond that, the commissary that the prisoners are forced to buy. Sure, it's a system. It's a business.
Yeah, and the phone calls. Apparently, they're making a fortune now on the phone calls.
Absolutely.
Bob Ney, the author of Sideswiped. If you want to know the whole story that Bob just started talking about, get a copy of his book. Bob, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. We'll be back with your questions about marijuana for Angela Baca. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.